six hunger-striking inmates whose health is deteriorating, with two of them not eating for over 100 days now. Well, the six prisoners are protesting against what Israel calls administrative detention, where neither are these individuals charged with a crime, nor are they released. The United Nations has said this action by Israel is against international law and illegal. But what does that mean when the words from the UN are not turned into actions to stop this tyranny? I'm going to cross over to Ramallah. Start this off by talking to Mona Candy. Mona, good to have you with us. Mona, please fill us in on the latest situation. We understand thousands of people have not eaten today, basically, in solidarity with those six. Just fill us in on what's going on.
Well, yes, Mercy, that's 4,500 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails have refused their meals in the Israeli jails, announcing a one-day hunger strike and imprisoning, warning that they might repeat this move. This means disobedience. This means challenging the Israeli prison authorities. They are standing with and supporting six Palestinian prisoners, as you have said. Those six Palestinian prisoners have been refusing food and on an open-ended hunger strike to protest the illegal administrative detention that allows Israel to keep Palestinians behind bars for indefinite periods of time without charge or trial. We are speaking about Heidi Fasfous, who has been on the hunger strike for 116 days. There is Mokhdad al-Qawasmi, who has been also refusing food on the hunger strike for 109 days. Both had been transferred to Kaplan Hospital. However, the Israeli authorities then returned them to the Israeli prison clinic, and they are refusing to deal with their demands. Experts are saying that the Israeli regime only ends the administrative detention of the hunger strikers when they become on the verge of death.
All right, thank you so much for that update out of Ramallah. That's correspondent on the ground there, Mona Candy. I'd like to introduce my guest to this program and welcome Mick Napier from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Edinburgh. And Charlotte Cates from the Samaritan Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network out of Madrid.
The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off with Charlotte. Now, Israel is suffocating Palestinians in every way it can, limiting their movement, their livelihood, their housing, their transport, their ability to complain and protest, and ultimately imprisoning Palestinians at will and killing many of them. What kind of existence is this for Palestinians, and why is it even allowed?
Well, as we can see, that for over 73 years, Palestinians have been fighting back against a brutal form of Zionist colonialism, which was supported and sponsored initially by the British Colonial Project in Palestine and has been since that time by the United States, by Canada, by European countries, and other Western imperialist powers who are doing their utmost to continue to support the colonization of Palestine. Despite that fact, Palestinians have been continuing to resist, to struggle, to fight back, and we see that today behind bars, where there are six Palestinian of justice, there is a tremendous imbalance of power in the world. And just as we see the tremendous crimes carried out by Western imperialist powers, the ongoing use of illegal sanctions, unilateral coercive measures to starve countries, invasions and occupations, the unstinting support, funding, and collaboration with the Zionist occupation of Palestine is part and parcel of those crimes, which is why it's so important not just to rely on the fact that that international law holds that Israel's ongoing actions are absolutely criminal and illegal, but to organize and fight back, to build the boycott of Israel, and to do everything that we can to support the Palestinians who continue to resist inside and outside Palestine for the liberation of Palestinian prisoners and for the liberation of all of Palestine. Because this is a crime, and Palestinians should not be left alone, and the Palestinian resistance must not be left alone to confront this by themselves. Instead,
okay.
This is an international crime.
Okay. Well, Charlotte says it's an international crime, Mick, but it is absolutely outrageous, the silence from the so-called international community. After the United Nations actually condemned Israel's administrative detention actions and called it and said it was against international law. But again, we see nothing is done. Why, Mick?
My own government continues to sell sniper rifle parts to the Israeli army. Every government, most of the governments in the EU, are very aware of what Israel's doing. But none of them, well, they divide into two, three groups. Those who enthusiastically support Israel in its criminality, those who don't care about weapons, and those who, like some of the Scandinavian countries, who really think it's terrible what's happening, but none of them will impose any sanctions on the state of Israel for its endless grotesque crimes against the Palestinians.
I guess the question would be why, Mick. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I guess the question would be why. What's in it for these Western nations, as you talked, even the Scandinavian countries that won't do anything? Why?
I think there's a couple of reasons. One, they defer to power. But the USA, Canada, Britain, and so on, they kind of find what Israel's doing very much their own history. Everything that Israel does to the Palestinians, pretty much, they learned from the United Kingdom during the Mandate. The house demolitions, the shootings, the entire toolbox of terror which Israel used against the Palestinians, detention without trial, mass incarceration, house demolitions and so on, all of that they learned from the British, and the British had been doing it around the world for a very long time before that. So what Israel's doing, when Ariel Sharon said the only good Arab is a dead Arab, he wasn't being original. He was just repeating something from the U.S. frontier, that the only good Indian is a dead Indian. So the whole idea of settler colonialism, of expelling the indigenous people with huge cruelty, was something that many Americans are quite comfortable with, people among the American elite, and the same in Australia, Canada, and so on, an atrocious history which Israel builds upon. So there's a cultural similarity. But also, I would argue, not everyone agrees, but I would argue that Israel fulfills a very important function for the West in controlling the resources of the Middle East, the markets, but also the hydrocarbons under the soil. Israel smashed Arab nationalism in 67. We all remember, if we're old enough, that Israel joined together with France and Britain when they were dominant powers in the Middle East to invade Egypt in the Suez Crisis. And Israel, I think, is the equivalent of a couple of aircraft carriers for the if they weren't putting those billions into Israeli militarism, one of their key spokespersons said they would probably need two aircraft carriers stationed permanently in the Eastern Mediterranean. So I think Israel provides a very important service. There's more to it than that, but I think it's a huge strategic asset. And currently at the moment, Israel, of course, is attacking Syria, overflies Lebanon, and it has a history of aggression against every single one of its neighbors. And that attack dog psychology, that attack dog nature of Israel, that's what I'm America's happy to pay for Britain to turn a blind eye to, and really for the Scandinavians sometimes to criticise, but never enough to impose serious sanctions upon Israel.
Well, Charlotte, let's talk about the desperation that these individuals have been brought to, that they think the only thing that they can do right now is sacrificing their lives, that there will be any attention brought to the plight of Palestinians in general and the thousands of Palestinian prisoners being illegally detained specifically.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it goes beyond desperation in many ways. These Palestinian political prisoners, and in fact, the entire Palestinian prisoners movement, has really been and stands every day on the front lines of struggle and confrontation and resistance inside the prisons, because every day they're facing down jailers, they're facing down guards, they're facing down a military court system, they're facing down administrative detention with no arms to fight with except for their bodies, except for their resistance and their steadfastness. And so we've seen throughout decades and decades of struggle that Palestinian prisoners have carried out hunger strikes, much like their colleagues, for example, in Ireland, in South Africa, and elsewhere, because these Palestinian political prisoners represent a political and a resistance leadership that is attempting to be isolated by the Israeli occupation. These Palestinian prisoners are not just desperate, they are also brave and heroic, and they are choosing to put themselves forward and to put themselves in danger, in incredible danger to their lives, in order to take a stand not only for themselves, but for all Palestinians jailed by the Israeli occupation and for an end to administrative detention. And of course, the entire system of colonial imprisonment of Palestinian prisoners. And it's because the Palestinian prisoners movement as a whole and the Palestinian people as a whole stand with the prisoners that we saw all across political lines, all Palestinian prisoners joining in today in this collective action of solidarity and of escalating struggle to support these hunger strikers and to say that these hunger strikers represent the movement as a whole in its demand not only to end administrative detention, to win freedom for these six prisoners, but to bring to an end this entire system of colonial incarceration that is used in an effort to suppress Palestinian resistance and organizing.
Well, Mick, you alluded to basically that Israel has learned from others like England, like the U.S. And of course, the main entity which led to its existence of the Israeli regime on Palestinian land is England itself, and it allowed for hunger strikers to die in 1981. Bobby Sands lost his life after starving himself to death because he wanted to be treated as a political prisoner, but former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher ignored him and let him die in prison. Do you think the UK's protege, Tel Aviv, wants to follow suit? Is that what we're looking at right now? Because we know that two of these prisoners now have been on a hunger strike for more than 100 days, and they're not showing any empathy at all.
No, you won't find any empathy. There's merely hatred and contempt. But the Israelis may be cruel and sadistic even something, but they're not stupid. And they in the past have dealt with hunger strikers very intelligently. I don't mean kindly, but intelligently. Because the Israelis know that under certain conditions, hunger strikers can evoke, can stimulate, can really galvanize a mass movement to even higher levels. That was one of Margaret Thatcher's huge mistakes in refusing political status and facing down the hunger strikers. What she scored was a Pyrrhic victory. Because Bobby Sands was elected to the Westminster Parliament, even as he was dying in the British prison system. And that hunger strike, when we look back upon it from today, was a huge turning point. It changed the electoral map of Northern Ireland and increasingly the whole of Ireland. So the Israelis understand very well when they negotiate with hunger strikers that this is a case, as your other guest has said, of enormous courage, enormous moral capital that these prisoners have. They're already resistance icons before they go into prison in their local community. But when they put their whole bodies against this brutal machine, where Amnesty International says torture is endemic in the Israeli prison system, when these men and women take these steps, that they know that the Israelis become a little bit afraid. And the record shows in the past that although they've pushed it to the limit and inflicted great suffering on the prisoners, at the end of the day they have been prepared, and they've often reneged on it afterwards. But they've been determined to avoid a crisis by making concessions to the hunger strikers. So the Israelis are telling us something, or they've told us something over the years, that the struggle of hunger strikers is a very powerful motivator for the wider population. And if I would add to that just one thing, during the recent fighting in May, people were amazed, and common as of every stripe, saw how the different sections of the Palestinian people, which the Israelis for decades had tried to split from each other, prevent from communicating, they came together in an unprecedented manner from Gaza, from inside 48, from the West Bank, from East Jerusalem. They welcomed the rockets from Hamas that were fired in defense of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So the hunger strike today, despite the enormous difficulties and fragmentation of the Palestinians because of the lack of a unified leadership, but the hunger strike today takes place on that basis, against that background, that the Palestinians have glimpsed the kind of unity that is possible when they struggle, and the hunger strikers will be making a contribution to that. I say that from the safety of someone not involved in a hunger strike, but the record shows that movements like this, in struggle after struggle against colonialism, play an absolutely devastating role from the point of view of the occupier.
Well, Charlotte, do you think that, just like apartheid South Africa, that it will take global civil society to ostracize the regime, and this is what needs to be done in order to see a change in dealing with Israel in general?
Fundamentally, on the front lines of the struggle, those who are going to make the most important difference for the future for the liberation of Palestine is the Palestinian resistance. The Palestinian resistance inside Palestine and the Palestinian people and their resistance in organizing out Palestine in exile and diaspora. And of course, at the core of this movement is the Palestinian prisoner struggle. These over 4,500 Palestinians locked behind bars because they continue to represent a true vision of resistance and leadership and organizing for the Palestinian people, but also for Arab movements for justice and for the international social justice movement. These Palestinians who are being locked behind bars are heroes of justice to anyone in the world who cares about justice, freedom, liberation, democracy, equality, and all of the values that any progressive person upholds. However, it's also critical that people around the world act to support Palestinian resistance and organizing by isolating and boycotting the Israeli occupation state.
Well, let me just stop you right there, Charlotte. Let me just jump in here, because what you're saying is it's also important that people organize around the world. But, I mean, we look at something that's happening right now with these 4,500 prisoners in prison there illegally. At least six kids are also in prison, at least. And we don't hear a lot, of course, in corporate media. So one wonders how the message is going to get out to the majority of people in the world. Of course, there are stations like Press TV and other stations and social media. Is it enough? Your assessment of this?
No, I mean, it's not enough because it's never going to be enough until Palestine is liberated and until these systems of oppression are brought down. But the issue is that, you know, global civil society can play a role in boycotting Israel and supporting Palestinian resistance, but this can never happen outside of the victory of the Palestinian resistance itself. And this resistance is stronger and stronger and stronger by the day. And we can see that not just inside the prisons, but as we saw in May of this year, when the resistance was able to force the Israeli occupation to step back. But in terms of supporting that, yes, social media is important. Rely just on the big platforms that are owned by major tech companies that are hand in hand with the Israeli occupation to censor and shut down Palestinian accounts, as we've seen time and time again on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and otherwise. It's also really important that we build our own independent alternative media networks and also work within our communities, in our trade unions, in our churches, in our mosques, in our neighborhood committees, in our local
Nick, your assessment of the resistance itself, because as Charlotte talked about back in May, we see a big difference in the resistance year to year. Your take on your assessment overall on the resistance, and is that the key to the ultimate liberation of the Palestinians?
Well, those of us in solidarity who see ourselves as an extension of the Palestinian freedom struggle can only deliver solidarity to people who are struggling. We are incentivized, we are impressed, we are motivated by the heroism that we see in Palestine. And although things look extremely dark, I offer some words of hope. Only a few weeks ago, we had a Scotland-Israel football game here, an international. And a few days ago, and when the Israeli national anthem was played, the crowd booed. They demonstrated, masses of people, their contempt for Israel. And I see now that FIFA has imposed a fine upon the Scottish Football Association. The efforts that they are going to try to prevent it spreading, the popular feeling against Israel is already there. Every opinion poll shows that Israel is already a polecat state. It's a pariah state in terms of what masses of people think. Now, the efforts that are being undertaken at the moment by the Israelis and their allies to suppress and censor pro-Palestine activism, they're telling us something very loud and clear. They're afraid. Now, how that plays out, when that reaches critical mass, when something like the Block the Vote in California and India and Scandinavia begins to come together to a sufficient power and to help defeat Israel, we don't know. But we know that it's only going one way. It's not going fast enough, but the Israeli crimes are eating at the support that it has around the world.
Okay.
And ultimately, that can play a significant auxiliary role to the Palestinian resistance.
All right. And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you being with us here on Press TV, Nick Napier, Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Edinburgh, and Charlotte Cates from the Samadou and Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network out of Madrid. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. Those whose scales are heavy with good deeds, it is they who are the successful.
The 102nd verse of the chapter says, فَمَنْ ثَقُلَتْ مَوَازِينُهُ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْمُفْلِحُونَ. Then, whoever's scale be heavy, those are the ones who shall be prosperous. After talking about some of the aspects of the Day of Resurrection, this verse talks about another aspect of the Day of Judgment. On Judgment Day, the first event is the evaluation of deeds according to a special measure which has been appointed for it. A group of people have some noble and righteous actions which will weigh heavy on that measure, and as a result, they will be successful. فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْمُفْلِحُونَ. They will be prosperous. The verse says, فَمَنْ ثَقُلَتْ مَوَازِينُهُ. Whoever's scale be heavy, فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْمُفْلِحُونَ. Those are they who shall be prosperous. The Arabic word مَوَازِين, which the verse says, فَمَنْ ثَقُلَتْ مَوَازِينُهُ, is the plural form of the word مِيزَان, and the word مِيزَان means a scale. Now, we should note that the concept of scale here is not meant as the ordinary scale and the like of it, but it is used for measuring the things, and also it is not restricted to just the common means whereby physical qualities and quantities are measured, but includes non-material objects, and in fact, everything that has happened in the world. In other words, scale has a very vast meaning here, which envelops all means of measurement. According to different narrations, the scales or criteria for measuring human beings, the actions of human and even humans themselves, they are the great leaders and ideal human beings. So we have many different criteria and many kinds of scales for the Day of Resurrection, for the Judgment Day. For example, in one tradition, we read Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, and the Imams among his descendants are the scales of measure. So in this case, we have Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen and his sons as the measures and the scales of the Day of Resurrection.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine.
In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Oh,
insights into the Holy Quran. I Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Human beings and their deeds altogether will be compared with the great prophets and their legatees. This comparison will make it clear to what extent they are on par with each other. So this is the way Quran says that in this way, good deeds and people can be distinguished from their bad deeds and good deeds, worthy and unworthy, heavy from light. The application of the word mawazin here, which is the plural form of mizan, is made clear now. The secret of this might be that the great leaders who are the criteria of this measuring are numerous. And as I said, they are only one part of the criteria. Another possibility, however, is that all of the prophets, imams, and the elects of Allah were models and ideals in one or many different respects, according to the different conditions of their lives. They have all had different conditions, different kinds of lives, and each one of them represented a shining sample of one particular quality and will be the criterion by which that quality or deed will be measured in others. So as a result, this world, all the deeds we have in this world, will be accounted on the day of resurrection, and only the ones who have something prepared for that day will be prosperous. أُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْمُفْلِحُونَ. Only they are the ones who shall be prosperous on that day. So, this verse, dear listeners, the 102nd, talked about one part of the deeds of the people in this world. In the next verse, however, we can see that it is implied that those whose scale of their deeds is light because of maybe lacking of faith in others, they are the ones who have lost their own capitals, and they are the real losers. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Of Jalali Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mohammed al-Houthi, has slammed the recent U.S. arms sale to Saudi Arabia, saying it confirms the contradiction in Biden's administration when it comes to Yemen. In a tweet, al-Houthi said, "The arms sales once again prove that the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden had no real intention to stop the support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen."
America.
The United States is leading the war on Yemen and supports the Saudi-led coalition logistically and militarily. Washington's claims that it would stop the war on Yemen are incorrect, and the evidence for that is the continuation of the U.S. support for terrorist groups across the country. And this was proved through what the Yemeni army found in al-Qaeda weapons warehouses with USAID logos.
Observers say Biden's promises to stop the war in Yemen have been nothing but lies to gain more votes in the elections. They say the new U.S. missiles sold to Riyadh will be used to bomb Yemenis and fighter jets such as F-15 and not as defensive weapons, contrary to what Washington claims.
The pre-election statements of the U.S. administration were only aimed at winning more votes, and the promises that the support for the Saudi regime and the war on Yemen would be halted were false. The U.S. administration proved that it supports the Saudi regime and that it only seeks to earn more money. The new deal is for offensive weapons. So, the new U.S. administration is directly contributing to killing more Yemenis.
Saudi Arabia, with Washington's support, launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015. Over the years, the kingdom has used internationally prohibited weapons, including the U.S. cluster bombs, to target residential areas, according to the Cluster Munition Monitor.
Yemenis have long been accusing the U.S. of being the main supporter of the brutal Saudi-led war on their country. People here say they will continue to support Yemen's armed forces, as the armed struggle seems to be the only way to force Riyadh to stop its years-long war and siege. Abdulatif Washali, Sana'a.
Hundreds of anti-establishment protesters linked to the global hacktivist group Anonymous near the British Houses of Parliament under heavy police presence in a demonstration dubbed the Million Mask March.
They have a long list of grievances, from the government's performance on the climate crisis to its response to the pandemic to infringement of civil liberties, as well as its support for military intervention abroad.
It's all corruption. It's all fakery as well. They benefit from wars. We don't. We wouldn't have a war. All of these Senate arts and everything, yeah, we care about the people, of our families who have died, but none of these people would have voted for any war, any war. The governments do that, and we have to go around, you know, like, praising them up or doing what they say. No. No.
The event happens on the same date every year, the 5th of November, a date associated with an attempted attack on Parliament in 1605. But instead of the traditional burning of an effigy of one of the culprits by the name of Guy Fawkes and a bonfire each year, the group don masks made popular by the novel and movie V for Vendetta. They say they're symbolic of standing up to power. They also wear them to protect their identities, to remain anonymous. To their supporters, they're freedom fighters or digital Robin Hoods. Among the crowd, the Palestinian flag, and supporters of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, jailed in the UK.
As you've seen with Julian's case, it's the judiciary system. The whole system is corrupt from the roots. You have political prisoners, you have a war on the free press and independent journalists. I know a journalist here who's been arrested before just for filming the police, their criminality. We're not, if anyone thinks we live in a democracy, they really need to wake up. They need to wake up. We're not in a democracy. Democracy has several pillars. One of them is free press. One of them is the right to assemble, free speech. All of these are dead.
The mostly peaceful Million Mask March started in 2003. And has grown bigger in number. A grassroots group that says it aims to shed light on government corruption and protect liberty. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The United States has approved a potential weapons sale worth hundreds of millions of dollars to Saudi Arabia. On Thursday, the Pentagon said the proposed sale of 280 advanced air-to-air missiles was approved by the State Department in late October. The deal is valued at up to $650 million. The State Department said the sale is fully consistent with the administration's pledge to co-lead with diplomacy to end the conflict in Yemen while also ensuring Saudi Arabia has the means to defend itself. Yemen's Ansarullah movement reacted, saying the arms sales prove that U.S. administration has no real intention to stop the Saudi onslaught on Yemen. This is seen as the first major arms sale to Riyadh since President Joe Biden took the helm at the White House. But such weapons transfer is not limited to the current administration. In May 2017, former President Donald Trump signed a mega weapons sales deal worth $110 billion in a meeting with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The recent deals have made Saudi Arabia become the largest importer of American arms and munitions. According to a report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, one-fourth of America's arms exports go directly to the kingdom. The report also says that between 2016 and 2020, Saudi weapons purchases only from the United States accounted for 79% of the country's total arms imports. Many believe the U.S. weapons sales to Saudi Arabia serves no one but arms manufacturing companies.
These are offensive weapons to be used against the resistance in Yemen, so it should absolutely be condemned. And the violation of President Biden promising to lead with diplomacy, and once again, its weapon sales, which benefit Raytheon, benefit the Saudi monarchy, but no one else.
But the United States is not the only country that provides Saudis with weapons. The UK, Canada, Spain, France, Italy, and Germany are among other major exporters of weapons to the Al-Saud dynasty. The arms supplies of Saudi Arabia have already sparked global criticism, given the kingdom's devastating war on Yemen since March 2015. Anti-war and human rights organizations have long sounded the alarm over the loss of human lives as a result of the West-backed Saudi aggression on Yemen. It seems the U.S. and its Western allies have no concern for misery the Saudi-led coalition have been inflicting on Yemenis. They are rather concerned about petrodollars they receive in return for those weapons being used in the impoverished Arab country.
Last-minute high-level talks in Paris to avert French sanctions on the United Kingdom did not produce any breakthrough, but both sides have agreed to continue discussions. A dispute over fishing boat licensing surprisingly ballooned into swift threats of sanctions and bans on using French ports unless London backed down. The row only concerns about 200 French fishing boats, some of which may be unable or unwilling to prove that they have not been fishing illegally in UK waters. The extremely low economic impact of the dispute has many saying the affair has become overly politicized, with French President Emmanuel Macron posturing ahead of re-election next spring, and the UK with their own questionable motives.
We see the economic problems the UK is having after Brexit, with shortages of gas and goods that appear rather serious. This dispute allows their government to focus attention elsewhere. But fishermen of both nations always have an interest in finding harbors. better and sharing natural resources.
But the dispute does reveal the complex and long-lasting nature of the Brexit secession. Analysts say that as the UK's largest trading partner, the European Union holds the best cards. Tougher customs checks, which have not been implemented since Brexit, could cause major delays for British companies and costs which far outweigh sales of fish. France's Prime Minister recently shocked many when he asked the head of the European Commission to, quote, show that it is more damaging to leave the Union than to stay in it. The openly punitive stance has many saying it's an unabashed method to keep countries in the European Union, not by persuasion, but by intimidation.
The EU still doesn't exclude the use of sanctions, but they have consistently been in favor of more negotiations. Our government has said they will follow the lead of the Brussels. So many French fishermen have a real feeling of injustice and of being neglected. We certainly hope our government will put pressure on London, because we cannot go on like this with major losses.
Many expect Brexit to become a perpetual problem in UK-EU relations. And with France, sometimes an ally, sometimes a competitor, but always a neighbor, bilateral relations are likely to get more strained as Brexit solidifies into permanence. Rami Mazaheri, Paris.
Former prosecutor, anti-corruption maverick, and political novice Yoon Suk-yeol Friday won the nomination to run for president of South Korea for the Conservative People Power Party.
Well, here's how I leave. The South Korean people, who want to restore fairness and common sense in our society, have chosen me, a political novice. Instead of happiness, I feel a sense of responsibility and duty to achieve a change of government.
Former provincial governor Lee Jae-myung won the Democratic Party nomination October 10th and proposes a universal basic income among several liberal policies.
Rooting out unfairness, inequality, and corruption, and making a wealthy country where workers are respected are the clear and stern commands from the public.
Early polling shows the candidates running neck and neck.
I support Yoon Suk-yeol because I think that the government of this country ridiculing people should be replaced as soon as possible, because lies after lies continue.
I support Lee Jae-myung because he has gone through very difficult times and overcome everything by himself to get where he is now, and he is open and above board as well as firm.
The two main candidates for president of South Korea, conservative Yoon Suk-yeol and Democrat Lee Jae-myung, clash on a number of issues, including North Korea policy. Lee favors peace-building engagement with Pyongyang, whereas Yoon advocates strengthening the alliance with the United States through regular military exercises. South Korea's presidential election is slated for March 9th next year, with the winner set to serve a single five-year term. Frank Smith, Seoul.
France has been shocked by a report which found that 20% of all the nation's hospital beds have been closed since the start of the pandemic. That total number of closed beds is twice as many as in 2019. Which also reveals that hospitals have been running at under capacity for some time. Unions gathered to clarify the situation, and they said it's even worse than it seems. The 20% number includes private hospitals, but it's public hospitals which have seen their funding cut almost annually since 2009. As recently as the year 2000, France's medical system was ranked number one in the world by the United Nations. That claim can no longer be made following more than a decade of austerity, and perhaps no group has protested as often in recent years as medical professionals. It's not only the lack of resources which is keeping hospitals underutilized or even closed, but also a lack of medical personnel. Studies show that during the age of austerity, public jobs, once eliminated, are not returning, even in hospitals during a once-in-a-century pandemic. What unions repeatedly accused is that the coronavirus is being instrumentalized by France's neoliberals to accelerate their open and long-standing goal of defunding public services, even amid the corona instability.
se servent de ça.
We have this conviction that the government is manipulating Corona because they were forcing the cuts before Corona. Only the cuts are now coming even faster. In the middle of a pandemic, hospitals are being closed and services are no longer being offered, from our biggest and best public hospitals to smaller ones.
For public medical professionals, working conditions and pressures have dramatically worsened over the last 20 months, causing many to quit and turn over to the private sector. Unions say many of those resigned posts also never get refilled. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
Soon after, Prime Minister Modi won a landslide victory in the 2014 general elections. Like other leaders, he wouldn't shy away from talking about the spirit of democracy. The Prime Minister said democracy will sustain only by freedom of speech and expression. But in Modi's new India, it looks like a different story altogether. Journalists in the world's largest democracy are caught in a limbo, not just about how to report, but also what to report. Many fear for personal safety, right to report the facts, while others are intimidated, harassed, and even charged under draconian and sedition laws, some are threatened aggressively. A poignant case is that of Indian journalist Neha Dixit, who revealed a horrifying ordeal while receiving a prestigious International Press Freedom Award.
The last couple of years have been about endless follow-up on legal cases, death threats and rape threats, complete with descriptions of how it should be conducted on my body. They've also been about being held physically hostage by right-wing Hindu fundamentalists while reporting.
Nevertheless, the show goes on while tuning in to watch your favorite prime time, where abuses, yelling, personal attacks, and at times cracking laughter is a routine. According to New York-based hybrid research and journalism organization, The Police Project, 256 reports of violence against journalists in India were recorded from May 2019 till August 2021. Media experts say press freedom has further diminished after the emergence of Hindu nationalist government of the ruling BJP. Recent years have seen a dramatic rise in violence against journalists while they were covering stories on different issues. Social media is also becoming a tool for trolling and threatening not just journalists, but anyone. Many renowned journalists and media personalities have now shifted their platforms in the pursuit of truth and perhaps the other way of the narrative. Rather than appearing on big platforms, they have resorted to social media as an easy tool to put forth their side of the stories.
There is a culture which is not limited to one political party or a particular government, but there's a culture now that has been developed where people who kind of bring out inconvenient truths are questioned.
Experts say after the emergence of BJP in India, there is a sense of polarized environment where journalists find themselves more divided, while many are still confused if it's all about patronizing the popular rather than speaking about the unpopular. But the never-ending or perhaps unwanted debates find more space in Indian media platforms rather than the ones that makes difference. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Europe's vaccine rollout got off to a rocky start at the end of 2020, and now, almost a year later, even distribution across the bloc has not been achieved. In Romania, only 30% of the population is vaccinated. Now it's in the grips of its most deadly wave, with all intensive care beds full and patients being turned away. In Germany, 65% of the population are double jabbed, but some regions are going into lockdown again, and those refusing the jab are being barred from indoor spaces. And in Britain, 67% of the population is double jabbed, and 8 million people have received booster jabs. Nonetheless, with social distancing laws scrapped, numbers are skyrocketing. While some countries are still struggling to give everyone a first and second dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, others are rolling out booster jabs.
And the blame game is in full swing. Governments are slamming vaccine hesitancy and lack social distancing, while citizens across Europe are saying they just don't trust the people in charge. The very same leaders who promised poorer nations their fair share of vaccines, but have not delivered.
The World Health Organization has slammed the likes of Britain and Israel for rolling out booster shots, while the majority of poor countries countries haven't even vaccinated their most vulnerable.
The cruise in the name is a pandemic, and until everybody is vaccinated and everybody is safe, then nobody, theoretically, is safe. And we are seeing what's been called vaccine nationalism, vaccine apartheid, and this is part of Western hegemony, Western hegemonic values, a sense of Western exceptionalism, that poor countries, they can wither on the vine as long as we've got enough vaccines. And it's a case in point that Western countries are far more their vaccines in store than what they really need. But there's a reluctance to give out these vaccines, one, because there's a selfishness that is part and parcel of Western society and Western ideology, but also, I think, a sense that Big Pharma wants to start making a profit from these vaccines and is not minded to give them out for free or at cost, as they were to Western countries and Western governments. It's all about power, it's all about imperialism, and it's sowing dragon's teeth in a time of pandemic.
Vaccine apartheid is to no one's benefit. It undermines a global recovery and allows more virulent virus variants to appear. Scientists warn waning immunity from vaccinations could mean many more people across Europe getting sick and dying this winter. Yank Rahimi, London.
To fish or not to fish, at the center of an escalating row between France and Britain, after France seized one British trawler and fined another for not playing by the new rules.
The UK used to be part of the EU common fisheries policy that allowed all European vessels equal access to these waters. But after Brexit, everything changed. Now both the EU and UK vessels have to have licenses to be able to fish in each other's territorial waters. And not only that, they have to prove that they have done so in the past.
To make things more complicated, the self-governing British territories of Jersey and Guernsey and the Channel Islands issue their own licenses. France accuses the UK of granting a small number of licenses it's entitled to. Britain denies that.
The French have behaved unfairly. You know, it's not within the terms of the trade deal. And if somebody behaves unfairly in a trade deal, you are entitled to take action against them and seek some compensatory measures.
But why is this happening now? In France, it might have something to do with an upcoming election.
There is an election coming up, and therefore President Macron would like to wrap himself in the flag, and particularly if it's opportunity of actually having a go at the British. But also there's an issue that actually, in terms of a broader EU sense, that actually want to make sure that Britain isn't seen to be benefiting by leaving the Union.
And on this side of the channel, it's all about reminding British voters of the perks of Brexit.
The British Prime Minister, Johnson, is trying to make sure that he is seen to be strong, standing up against the French, and that Brexit is being a success. The fishing industry as a part of the economy is tiny in Britain, but it's a very emotional issue. And of course there, he said he would be standing up and protecting the fishing industry, and frankly, he hasn't been doing so.
The French have threatened to prevent British vessels from docking at their ports if the issue isn't resolved soon, against Britain's threats of legal action. For now, though, the two sides seem to have hit the pause button on tit-for-tat measures. Key talks are set for later this week, with experts saying the risk of further escalation remains. Saeed Pourriza, Dover, United Kingdom.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, this is your host Musa al-Bahari, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic beliefs. Joining me in the studio today is a dear friend, Sayyid Muhsin Naqvi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qom. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you, and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaykum assalam wa